This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of Your Legal Rights, we're going to be doing this. Will or does the sharing economy, also known as the gig economy, such as Uber, Airbnb, and Lyft, benefit employment and the American economy? So that's what we're going to be talking about. And in the second half hour, for those of you who are listening to the program live, when we're doing this on August 17th, you'll have a chance to call in and talk with my guests. My guests are business and employment law attorneys Tad Devlin, a partner in the San Francisco law firm of Kaufman, Dolowich, and Volokh. Is that the correct pronunciation?
That's Volokh? Right.
Oh, I got it. Good, good. And my other guest is Aaron Minnis, a partner in the San Francisco law firm of Minnis and Smollett. And my guests are panelists for the San Francisco Marin Lawyer Referral and Information Service of the San Francisco Bar Association. And this segment of Your Legal Rights is funded by the San Francisco Bar Association. Additional funding for the program is also made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law Section of the State Bar, and the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar. Gentlemen, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Nice Great to have you here.
Nice to be here.
In that not all of us, including myself, are that familiar with the sharing economy or the gig economy, and I'd like to find out how we ever got that name. Tell us a little bit about it. Who wants to start? If you would, Aaron, what does this mean, the sharing economy?
Well, when I think of the sharing economy or the gig economy, I look at it from an employment law perspective, and I basically liken it to freelancing or being self-employed and the opportunities and the drawbacks that come along with that.
Which means if you are an independent contractor or an independent contractor, not an employee, you are not getting all of the benefits that you might get as an employee of some business. Isn't that correct?
Right. For example, so if you were a driver for Uber, you would be considered not an employee but a contract, an independent contractor of Uber. And as an independent contractor, you would not have the legal protections that would apply in the traditional employment situation.
Such as what?
Well, for example, you wouldn't have health insurance. You wouldn't have workers' comp insurance. You probably wouldn't have any paid time off. The laws that require family or medical leave would not apply to you. Some of the laws that prohibit discrimination in employment would not apply to you. So a lot of the standard protections or benefits that we think of and we associate with the employment relationship don't apply to all of these people who are out there driving for Uber.
Is this then, and there's another business where people are driving as independent contractors called Lyft, is that right, L-Y-F-T?
Correct.
Is this then, this whole thing that's become, I think it's not only national but international to some degree, mm-hmm. is this kind of hurting people who might otherwise have been employees? Because now if you've got jobs that are now being offered to people as independent contractors and taking away from what otherwise would have been an employment situation, is this increasing people who are not employees and therefore not having all of these benefits?
I don't really think of it as taking something away from somebody. I think like any relationship, there are benefits and there are drawbacks to the relationship. Mm-hmm. And so I think it provides working for a company like Lyft or whatever company that we can think of. Uber's not the only one. There are a lot of other ones. It provides a lot of benefits to these people. They have the freedom to set their own schedules. They may be able to organize their daily activities being a driver or participating in these activities, which allows them perhaps to work from home, watch the kids, pursue a passion or a project they like, and then set their work schedule around those things. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely a lot of benefits to having that type of relationship. Another thing that signing up to drive for Uber or Lyft or what have you is that they're very low barriers to entry. I mean, if you think about being self-employed or being an independent contractor or consultant, I mean, part of the hard work is finding your first client. Mm-hmm. But if you go to work for a company like Lyft or Uber, you basically join a platform where the clients are brought to you. And the mechanism and the context for all of that is in place.
One of the things that I have in my research on this that concerns me, and I think it is a criticism of Uber and Lyft. For example, in Houston, Texas, the city prohibits Uber from conducting business there because it's not complying with properly vetting the drivers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know you're familiar with at least another city in Texas like that, Tad. What comments do? What does that mean from the citizen standpoint? Someone, a member of the public who, let's say, might want to have Uber or Lyft or whatever. If generally speaking, and I know when I've taken, for example, licensed cab drivers and they've complained about Uber, they're saying that Uber is not licensed by the state and therefore this is adversely affecting licensed cab drivers.
Well, I think it's turned into a political battle as well, really, along these city lines. And the Uber and the Lyft have become transportation network companies compliant with Sacramento and California in terms of their vetting and the regulatory enforcement. So I think the bigger companies are becoming more of staid and reliable, removing the risk.
You're talking about Uber and Lyft. Lyft. Yeah. I see. Yeah. Okay. What initial comments do you have
about this
whole situation?
The sharing economy is also a different way of conducting commerce and monetizing some of the things we have in our cupboards or our vehicles or our homes. So I think it's a different way of engaging with the marketplace, and the regulatory and legal framework is what needs to catch up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about? Let me also mention this for everyone's benefit. The state of Massachusetts, in the state of Massachusetts, there's a class action lawsuit against Uber, with the focus that Uber exploits its drivers by misclassifying them as independent contractors to avoid paying them as employees. Do you have any comments about that?
Well, I think these are fierce battles, not just in Massachusetts, but in San Francisco. There's two big classification lawsuits regarding whether or not folks are independent contractors or employees. And the difference is that these laws have been on the books for a long time under the Borrello factors, I believe it is, which is a California Supreme Court case, which has factors to determine whether or not one mm-hmm. is an independent contractor or designated as an employee. What we've got here is a new mode of working. It's a new widget, if you will. It's a new employment function. And mm-hmm. so how do you overlay that with these factors where you can become a driver, like was Aaron was saying, with a phone, an app, and a car, whereas you don't have to go and become a cab driver by buying a medallion and becoming vetted, mm-hmm. Either licensing the car, purchasing the car, or somehow getting all the tools needed to become an employee.
Well, today, generally speaking, for Uber and Lyft, are they operating their own cars, or are they operating somebody else's car?
They are, and that's one of the big focal points for Uber is that mm-hmm. These are workers who are providing their instrumentality for the commerce. However, there are tie-ins to make the cars more affordable for Uber, so they have tie-ins with the auto dealers. Well, they'll help out with the financing, so that's a pushback from the plaintiff's lawyers in those litigations.
What about from the standpoint of protecting the public, the Uber drivers who are operating their own cars? What about the requirement of insurance, accident insurance on these cars? I presume under California law, whether you're an Uber driver or not, to legally be operating a car in California, you've got to have accident insurance on the car.
Yeah. I was, before we got on the air, anecdotally, I was in my first Uber bender.
You've just done that for the program, haven't you? You wanted to give us a little excitement
I'm sure. Before, I think that was a big hurdle that people...
This happened today?
It was less than a week ago.
Oh, so, I see. Okay.
Before, I think there was a big concern, and there still is, about whose car am I getting into? Who is this? How can I trust the rating service? Whereas you get in a cab, you have some comfort that they've been...
Well, you've got a
it's
corporation.
A cab. You get a yellow cab or whatever that company is, so you feel a comfort level, and you know they have an insurance program. When Uber first hit the scene, there were big... perceived gaps in coverage, and then it took a catastrophic event. I think somebody was crossing an intersection in San Francisco on New Year's, and there was a fatality, and that triggered, hats off to Uber, a a radical overhaul of the insurance program, and they're swift and on it now. And so there's periods of insurability, whether or not the driver's en route to pick you up, has you in the car, or has dropped you off. But one way or another, you're going to be taken care of.
What about Airbnb? Aaron, does that have some aspect to it of employment law, the Airbnb? This is the rental of housing, and of course that's also a national and, I guess, international thing. As a matter of fact, one of the things I want to mention to everybody is that my research shows that Airbnb has exceeded, and this was, I was amazed at this, 10 million guest stays to this point, if this is a current report, which I think it is, and 500,000 properties are listed. And I guess this is, I presume, across the country, not just in San Francisco or California. But do you get involved, or might the employment issues become involved with Airbnb, Aaron?
Well, I would look at it from a different perspective in terms of, you know, some of the same laws that prohibit discrimination in employment prohibit discrimination in housing. And so, for example, an issue may arise. What if you, what if you're looking at Airbnb or some of these other homestay apps, and you identify a certain way or are part of a protected class, but the person whose place you want to rent won't rent to you based on that protected status. So whether those laws that prohibit discrimination in housing would apply to somebody who only occasionally rents out their house on Airbnb.
Well, my understanding, there's been some controversy. Let's say both of you practice in San Francisco, but there's been some controversy regarding whether or not people who are involved with Airbnb, that is, homeowners or condo owners who are in connection with Airbnb, not properly paying taxes to the city and this kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about that, if you would, Tad?
Yeah, I can, Chuck. Again, I think this is kind of the not quite connect or the disconnect between a hotel or a bed and breakfast tax that's on the books in San Francisco. It's the transient occupancy tax, and San Francisco was one of the first cities. Amsterdam was the first city to enact Airbnb laws, and I think San Francisco was the first domestic or U.S. city to do so. And then, how do you apply these bread and breakfast laws to these new short-term rentals? And are short-term rentals even allowed? And then San Francisco's Board of Supes approved measures, the Airbnb law, if you will, to legalize short-term rentals in San Francisco, but then you've got to push back based upon the housing stock, the limited housing stock, against folks who are saying, look, you're just taking stock away from the residents. But then the city's sitting there waiting for their tax money, and they've got a slower reaction because they don't have the data power and the human power like an Airbnb to actually collect the tax. So now they're at odds with Airbnb about privacy issues and revealing who the renters are and then collecting the tax and whose responsibility is to do so.
Is there a lawsuit about
this
right now?
There is.
In San Francisco? In the federal court?
Airbnb sued San Francisco, I believe, I'm not sure, I think in federal court, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
And when you're talking about privacy issues, what do you mean?
So people are grumbling about, look, you say that there's this registration requirement. You have to become a registered host. You have to become a registered Airbnb-er. And if you're not, then you're in violation of the law. But there's
in violation of what law?
It's an amendment to the rent ordinance in San Francisco.
In San Francisco, okay.
And so San Francisco, in my opinion, does not have the – they created a short-term rental division, but like many government divisions, they're not quite capable because they don't have the data power, the collection power, and the enforcement power to actually catch those who are not registrants who are renting. So there's folks who are renting their houses, but they're not registered. So then San Francisco was going to say, well, Airbnb, you tell us who all these people are and you go get it. And Airbnb said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to protect our users. And so we think that's unconstitutional, and there are other First Amendment issues that are at stake there.
Wow.
I think it'll end up like most litigation, resolving, and they'll reach a happy medium.
Really? Yeah. Do you? Yeah. My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, and perhaps this only pertains to San Francisco, there's only so many days a year that the owner of either a home or a condo can, let's say, deal with Airbnb in terms of renting it to people who are visiting the city or whatever it may be. Is that correct?
Yeah. So
How many days roughly is it?
90 days.
90 per year?
Yeah. So they don't – people – and understandably, you don't want to a hotel next door to you, if you will.
No.
There's zoning issues that are at stake.
So that is for the protection of one's neighbors, I presume. Mm-hmm. Is that the whole idea? Mm-hmm. You don't want to have people traipsing in and out all the time?
Well, you've also got a lot of landlord-tenant issues, so a lot of tenants will sublet out their places to make ends meet or even monetize their rental income, their rental intake over what their rental is to the landlord. And then you've got a lot of tenancies in common in San Francisco, and you've got house rules that are going to prohibit it and or CC&Rs that are going to limit it.
CC&Rs are what?
Covenants, codes, and restrictions.
Okay.
For a homeowners association. Yeah. So the rules of a shared building, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
A lot of rules.
Oh, boy, lots of rules. Comments on this at all? Aaron?
No, I mean, basically, I was actually interested to know if Tad knows if there's a private right of action for these laws. In other words, can a neighbor or a co-owner of a condo unit sue to enforce these laws?
Aaron's got his
very good.
Aaron and I are lawyers. We're making
Wait,
sure. Yes, there's
an
argument, and there is. You have a right to cure under the ordinance, and then if you don't cure, then there's a private right of action.
Give us a simple little example of what you're talking about.
So the city, you'll get a notice.
You as the owner of some property?
They catch you. It's pretty easy to catch you because you've got a listing on Airbnb, and I'll confess that we put one up during, when the sailing was here, the Cup?
America's Cup.
Yeah, so we put it up just to, or maybe it was
when
Super Bowl.
When you say we, you mean your wife?
Yeah, I'm confessing here. It was actually, maybe it was Super Bowl.
You put the kids out in the lawn there.
Yeah, I said, geez, we could go somewhere else and make $5,000 for the week or whatever, right?
Whoa.
Our landlord gave us a notice, I want to say the day of,
really?
Showing us our ad, and we put it up under a pseudonym. I don't know if this is a mission against interest. And I said, okay, you know, we got to pull the ad down. So we didn't go forward.
What was your landlord's problem with that?
We caught it's against the lease. It's you got to get
without permission of the landlord.
The landlord doesn't want you turning your community into a more from San Francisco, you'll get a notice of violation to answer Aaron's question. You'll get a notice of violation saying, "Hey, we understand you're in violation of the short-term rental ordinance. You have, let us come in and inspect." And I guess they're looking for indicia of a hotel or a B&B or not. And then you can respond. And then if they still think you've actually engaged in wrongful conduct, then you can cure. And if you don't cure, then the city can whack you with a penalty, and then somebody can come and sue you.
Wow.
So,
We're in the first half hour of the program, which is recorded, and we send it out to 15 other stations that air the half hour next week. For those of you listening to the live program, we will continue a full hour in just a few minutes. I'll give you our toll-free number, and you can call in, ask questions, make comments. We are live in the Bay Area. We're live on the Internet at www.klw.org for an hour. And the entire program is uplifted to the National Public Radio satellite. Some stations outside of California take the program live. Others take it and then air it delayed, obviously. So in the remaining few minutes we have in the statewide version, the half hour, what are some, would you say, some of the other benefits of both the Uber, Lyft, and Airbnb that you feel the general public might be interested in hearing about?
Well, I had a dovetails on that, Chuck, but I have a question for Aaron in that vein. I think I understood that a couple of companies like TaskRabbit or something said, we're going to remove the independent contractor model and go to a traditional employee model. Have you heard anything, or what would be the
now? What is
pros
the name?
And
what's
cons?
The name of the company?
I want to say it was TaskRabbit, where you can have somebody come and
Task Rabbit?
Rabbit, do your chores.
T-A-S-K Rabbit?
Yeah.
Do your chores.
And I was wondering, why would they do that to avoid
I would think that
litigation.
Avoiding liability yeah. would be a big reason to do that. You know, one of the biggest concerns that I have about this gig economy concept is that in California law, the law presumes that you're an employee. And it's actually the employer's yeah. burden yeah. to prove otherwise. Mm-hmm. It's to prove the worker is actually an independent contractor. Mm-hmm. And as Tad mentioned earlier, there's actually about 20 different factors that a court is going to consider to determine whether somebody's properly classified as an employee or an independent contractor. And the most important factor of all 20 of those factors is who has the right to control how and when and in what way the work is performed.
Yes, of course.
Right?
Of course.
So the biggest concern that I have about the gig economy is that a lot of people are focused on the technology aspect about the app and how you match up a driver to a passenger and so forth.
When you say the app, how does this work? I've never taken Uber. I don't know if I ever will, but what do you mean by the app?
Most times it starts with downloading an application onto your phone and giving them your information.
Really?
Right. And then you would give your information, your credit card information, and so forth. And let's just use a transportation app.
So for example, with Uber, if you want to use Uber on a regular thing, you would do this app and contact Uber, and you'd give them your name, your credit card number, et cetera?
You do that when you sign up.
And
then let's say you're downtown
like,
walking around after the theater.
It's like a membership.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I see.
So you're downtown walking around after the theater. You would open your app, and you would be able to see all of the different drivers that are around you. If you wanted to request a ride, then you just push the button, and they would match you up with the driver who's driving around, and they would come by and pick you up.
The convenience is I send them for my mom, and I – when my dad drives, she called it Grandpa, so it's Gruber. But I'll send one for her. It's very convenient. And then I pay for it. It's all on your digital,
wonderful.
On your phone. It's amazing.
That's so convenient.
But I think the litigation risk, I think Aaron's right. I mean, it's hard to measure these risks and as consumers, whether you're a driver or you're a rider or mm-hmm. you're a host of a home, you want to rent out your home, there's mm-hmm. risks. What are people going to do in your home? What if they trash your home? What if somebody has a bodily injury accident or worse at your home? And what if they're from an international country and they come here because we get a lot of mm-hmm. tourism here? And
yeah.
And so there are a lot of unknowns.
So if, for example, someone has become involved, the owner of a condo or the owner of a home has become involved with Airbnb, the owner of the property does not enter into, for example, if someone's going to be there for 30 days or whatever it may be, the owner of the property does not have that tenant, that temporary tenant, sign any kind of a lease or rental agreement. Is that right?
That's right.
You're relying that... Well, what is Airbnb?
If they stay past 30 days, then you're into traditional landlord-tenant law, and you've got to bring an eviction mm-hmm. action, and they squat their way, and there's been cases and write-ups about this, mm-hmm. that they overextend their stay, and they won't leave, and they become they get the protections of traditional landlord-tenant law, and you've got to notice an eviction.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
What does Airbnb do to let's say, vet the temporary tenants who may be coming into someone's home?
I think it's very largely a rating system. I mean, none that I'm aware of. There's no background check conducted. They don't come to your home. I've used Airbnb as a guest, and I've listed my home, and it's as easy as taking photos. This is the nimble nature of these companies and the ease of use. In my humble opinion, makes them they're not going away, because I was able to list my home with 5 photographs on my phone, and the ad was up, and I was getting responses immediately.
Really?
Right away.
But what does Airbnb do? Using Airbnb as the example, what does it do to with regard to someone who's going to be a temporary tenant? What kind of vetting does it do to see that this person is, let's say, not a criminal from wherever?
I'm not aware of
really?
Chuck. Yeah, and there was just something on the news about whether you've heard about the kids who have. There was a Hamptons incident where there was a big Hamptons party. I don't know. You may have read about it, and it was in the New York Times about whether the guy rented it, but there was somebody already staying there, so they had double booked it. But Airbnb wasn't aware of it because there was a mix up. Then the most recent kerfuffle I heard about was somebody engaging in the oldest profession in the world that was in a Silicon Valley very large home, and it was on the news because there were concerns that Airbnb hadn't vetted the guest who was engaging in the oldest profession in the world at this at this big home.
Really?
Yeah. So I don't to answer your question, I think you may see more publicity about the need for Airbnb to get involved, but to me that cuts against the laissez-faire liberality of these companies that make it as easy as using your thumb on your phone.
How does then someone who has a property and wants to get involved with Airbnb, how does that person know whether or not the temporary tenant that Airbnb is going to connect to the property, that the property owner is going to actually get paid? Does Airbnb pay the property owner, or does the temporary tenant pay directly to the owner of the property, generally speaking?
The central hub for the monetary commerce is Airbnb.
So it is.
Yeah, and
so,
they get
so the tenant, the temporary tenant, pays Airbnb.
Who pays
the owner of the property. Right. My goodness, this is a pretty exciting thing, isn't it, really, here? Well, we have 30 seconds left in the statewide version of the program. Any outstanding comment you want to make, Aaron?
Just going back to a point that I was thinking about earlier, which is one of the interesting things about this gig model is that if you think about it, oftentimes the employer, quote-unquote employer, whether it's Uber or some other, is really passing along a lot of the costs of doing business to the actual workers, whether it's procuring insurance or arranging your own health care or buying your supplies and so forth.
All right, everybody, I want to give you a chance to call in, and this is your legal rights. Call in if you have a question, comment, whatever you might have about the sharing economy, also known as the gig economy. Our toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. By the way, I want to let you all know that if you are listening to the program live next week, which will be August 24th, that's our regular monthly Call a Lawyer night also, and I want to invite you to be able to talk with attorneys off the air. You might want to jot down the number. Again, this is if you're listening to the program live on August 24th. That number for Call a Lawyer is 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. Again, that is if you're listening to the program live next week on August 24th. Now, let me tell you who my guests are in case you tune in a little bit late. They are business and employment law attorneys Tad Devlin, a partner in the San Francisco law firm of Kaufman, Dolowich, and Volokh. My other guest is Aaron Minnis, a partner in the San Francisco law firm of Minnis and Smollett. And my guests are panelists for the San Francisco Marin Lawyer Referral and Information Service of the San Francisco Bar Association. That means that consumers who contact the San Francisco Bar asking to have a consultation with a lawyer for initially half an hour, both of my guests are panelists and who may, for example, in Aaron's situation, he may be asked to confer for an initial half an hour with someone asking about employment law questions. And for a Tad, it might be something to do with business or something like that. And support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. And that's both in San Francisco and, more recently, also in Marin County. For a referral to a lawyer or the Bay Area Mediation Services of the San Francisco Bar, you can call 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association, which is also a funder of this program, also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours, 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. In California, every county has a bar association and a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. You tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone, an attorney who's experienced in the area, setting you up for a half an hour consultation with the attorney. It's a great way to get some basic information about what your rights and obligations are. And with minor exceptions throughout the state of California, for a half an hour consultation, you'll pay something like $25 to $35, which is actually a very good investment for some basic legal information. And that money doesn't go to the lawyer. It goes to the lawyer referral service to keep it going. So that's the beauty of that. Additional funding for Your Legal Rights is made also by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, by the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and by the San Mateo County Bar Association. So for those of you who would like, a lot of people want to talk with you, we're going to start with Jimmy. Jimmy, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hey, thanks for having me. A little earlier, one of your attorneys was mentioning that when we monetize our personal items, and he mentioned things in the cupboard or someone's car, that with the example of cars, that maybe the Uber drivers and the Lyft drivers get a favorable rate from the car dealers. And I just wanted, in the interest of truth, to counter that by saying I worked at three different car dealerships. One was called Toyota, one was called Mercedes, and one was called Honda. And every single person who came in to do an Uber deal, and I did 19 in a month, had a interest rate through that program that was, the lowest was about 22.5%, and the highest APR that somebody was paying was 26%. And by and large, what I saw were, you know, middle-aged guys living on their parents' couch come in, and nobody had a credit score of 700 who came in to drive Uber. Mm-hmm. And similarly, nobody from Yale or Dartmouth was coming in to drive for Uber. It was a lot of people who were down on their luck who were coming in and going, gee, I'm interested because this is kind of my last ditch. I'm living, like I said, on my mom's couch. And the interest rates were 22.5% to 26%,
wow,
which, you know, some people would say borders on usury.
Whoa,
and
I'll
so
say.
I just wanted to counter in the interest of somebody putting out there that in the sharing economy, that there's some sort of friendly, sort of reach from these companies like Uber, and they're just going through people and then get more, because San Francisco State is going to graduate more students next semester and next semester. And the people that you see with the Lyft and the Uber, they're not, they're, those are people who are just hanging on in this economy, and they're paying 26% interest. Mm-hmm. So please don't characterize it as some sort of great deal coming down from the business gods that.
Jimmy, what do you do now?
Now I sell something other than cars, because I felt very terrible about being in there and doing these deals. And there were more people coming in every day, and they were buying Priuses.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were buying the Priuses, they were going, I don't care. I would look at people and go, you don't want to pay 26%, because
wow,
I have a degree, and I kind of know what that really means, how much you're really paying for it.
Well, I appreciate you calling and telling us about this. I'm going to get some comments from my guests, so thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, take care. What comments do you have in
sure,
response to Jimmy?
Sure. What I had referred to is what I understood was there was an incentivized program in place through one of the car dealers and car automakers. But I'm not. I don't disagree with Jimmy that there are a lot of Priuses out there.
Yeah.
I think you get many different kinds of I've had many different kinds of Uber drivers, across every demographic line.
Mm-hmm.
So it's folks who, as Aaron was referring to earlier, they're doing this on the side so they can pursue another passion. It's a means to an end. It's a supplementation mechanism, but it's created opportunities. But there's all kinds of folks driving.
How about you, Aaron? Any comments of what Jimmy had to say?
Yeah, I thought Jimmy's point was really interesting. You know, without casting aspersion on the Uber driver, the Lyft driver, whoever. I agree. There's a huge cross-section of people at various different points in their life. Mm-hmm. Some of these people are in transition between school and work. Some of these people are in transition between employment and new employment.
Yes.
And they're looking for ways to make money and be productive during those transitions. And I think that's an incredible service. But I also think that the benefit of an employment relationship is that it provides structure to your life. Mm-hmm. You get up, you go to work, you work regular hours, you're accountable, you're evaluated, and you progress in your career.
Yes.
And you become the sum of all your skill and experiences in your career. Mm-hmm. And it makes you into a more enlightened person. So I don't disparage anybody who would drive for Uber or Lyft. Mm-hmm. There's wonderful people who do it, and they're all different types of people. And when you get into an Uber, you meet the most interesting types of people with great stories. Yeah.
Well, I hope we have an Uber driver or a Lyft driver or someone who's been involved with Airbnb to join us with a question or a comment. Again, our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And we have Lee, who's on the line. Lee, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I am wondering why there's so little oversight, quality control, and any other sort of checking and vetting of these processes and businesses that are launched upon us. And then all of a sudden we're going, oh, well, I guess we better look at what they're doing and figure out how to maybe, you know, exert some control. And why is it always in hindsight? And I have to tell you that after staying at two Airbnb properties that were just horrible and not as advertised, I will never, never, ever do it again.
Really? Mm-hmm. Really?
Yep.
What city was this in, Lee?
They were both in California.
Okay.
And one was in Marin, and it had dog feces all over the place. And our room was right next to the washer and dryer, and the owner was this surly, bitter young woman who was trying to make her way in life by basically getting as much as she can from anybody she can get it from. And I was just appalled and disgusted. And, you know, when I contacted Airbnb and let them know, they acted like I was in the wrong and I was the one who had to go and make amends with this person. It was just ridiculous.
So you did not get any kind of refund of what you had paid?
God,
and
no.
I presume you paid a fairly good amount just to stay there.
I did.
Yeah.
And
well, let me get some comments for you, Lee. I appreciate you saying that. That's
it was horrible.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. By the way, did you pick up the dog feces? I'm just joking. Thank you very much for calling. What comments do you have for Lee? Tad,
this
please.
Is Tad. Yeah, that's unfortunate to hear. I think I've had those experiences on a personal level and on a professional level where folks are it's not quite as advertised when you show up, and it doesn't the housing doesn't match the pictures online. Mm-hmm, I think it's also I do this. You got to really do your due diligence on the reviews, whether it's TripAdvisor or Uber's a bit difficult.
By going on Google and googling it.
I think you got to try it. It is a little time consuming. You got to exhaust more efforts and read more online information. Mm-hmm. And I think that the pricing mechanism. I'm kind of supporting the laissez-faire Adam Smith economic theory, but the pricing mechanism builds it in. You can stay for $500 a night at a Marriott, or you can stay and you kind of know what you're going to get because it's got the Marriott
it's got
brand.
A reputation.
So we just did that on a family vacation. My wife wanted to go up the road at an Airbnb, but for a vacation, I didn't want to have what happened to Lee.
Yeah.
I wanted to know when I got to Maui that the umbrella was going to be up on the beach and my chair was going to be there. And
that's a great point. If you're staying at a Sheraton or a Marriott or a Westin, you can expect a certain minimum standard or level of service.
Which is a good standard.
Yeah. You know what you're
generally
getting.
Speaking.
And the gig economy, there is a little, there's uncertainty there, whether it's a ride or, But that maybe the price is the equalizer there.
Yeah. Well, they also rely a lot on ratings. So customer ratings. So somebody stays at your house and you get enough people staying at your place and they'll rate you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 stars.
When you say they will rate you, you mean the Airbnb
consumer,
will?
The consumer.
The consumer. So, you can find that by Googling.
When you are looking at the properties where you want to stay, or even after you've gotten out of a car, you've taken a ride with Uber, you have the opportunity, you as the consumer have the opportunity to rate your experience. And those ratings will be compiled and they'll be available to other consumers who are going to book that
service. How would they be available? How can you find that?
Through the Uber or Airbnb website.
And so back to Lee's question, how are these regulating? They're almost self-regulating companies.
So in other words, at the Airbnb website, there would be a listing of an address in a city, and you could take a look at that and see how the consumers responded to that?
Correct.
Okay, that's good to know. Is that the same thing with Uber?
Yes.
Yes. That's good. All right. By the way, I've been wanting to ask you this, and we've gotten so many issues. Where did the term gig come up for this?
I think it's just because if you get a new gig, it's as simple as that. I'm pretty sure.
You're right.
That's hilarious. Yeah. That's hilarious. Oh, my gosh. Okay. All right. Dee, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi.
Hi.
My employer's family recently asked me to become an independent contractor so he could avoid payroll taxes. I'm a caregiver, and I'm balking at this.
We're having a problem with your phone. Are you on a cell phone?
Yes, I am.
It's kind of conking out. Do you have a landline phone, Dee, that you can call back?
No, I don't.
All right, we'll try to bear with it. Keep going.
Okay, so. I hope you got that, but my employer's family have asked me to become an independent contractor so he won't have to pay payroll taxes.
And you are a caregiver?
Yes.
Okay, gotcha. Go ahead.
So it's my understanding, first of all, that it's illegal for a caregiver to be an independent contractor. And I'm wondering, we're going to have a meeting, and I'm wondering what I can actually bring forward at this meeting to present to them.
Do you have a background of being a caregiver, Dee?
Yes.
You
for
do.
For the last 12 years.
And are you involved with some kind of an organization that finds clients for you?
No, I'm an independent.
You are an independent. Okay. Do we have enough information from Dee? Okay.
I really appreciate this caller's question.
This is good.
Because this is something that you and I were talking about, Chuck, before we went on air. This model that a lot...
Dee, why don't you turn your radio back up so that you can hear what Aaron has to say.
Okay. All righty.
Thank you very much for calling, and Aaron's going to respond to your concern. Go ahead.
So obviously I can't analyze her situation based on the limited information we have but I can give a few concepts. Number one is the law presumes that there's an employment relationship as opposed to an independent contractor relationship. Okay, so that's number one. So if there's a change in that relationship, it's going to be the employer's responsibility to show that the worker is properly classified. Mm-hmm. So she's got the law on her side.
Yeah.
If she is presumed to be an employee and an employee makes a complaint that they're being misclassified or they're not being paid properly according to the employment laws, such as being paid at least a minimum wage or in some cases an overtime rate, then the law considers those types of complaints to be protected activity, which means that an employer can't legally fire an employee for raising those concerns. That's called retaliation, and it's unlawful. So one of the things that we were talking about, Chuck, before we got on air, was that some of the efficiencies that companies like Uber and Airbnb and Lyft and all these use by having many, many, many independent contractors running their business, conducting their business, and relying on these people to give rides and so forth, are starting to seep out into other employment contexts.
Such as a caregiver type of thing.
Such as caregivers or people that work at tech companies. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a year ago, I had somebody call me who lives in San Francisco, who had many roommates that they were sharing a place with, and said that he had been working for a tech company for over a year and that he wasn't being paid.
Wasn't being paid at all.
He wasn't being paid at all. The way that the employer was compensating was by giving stock options.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And this is a company that's privately held. It's not – you can't do anything with the stock or the options because you can't transfer them. They're restricted.
You can't sell them. And is that what you're saying?
That's correct. And the whole thing that they're banking on is that some point in the future this company would make it big and be able to sell their shares to somebody on the open market.
To the public, yeah.
But in the meantime, they weren't getting paid. And the law says that if you're an employee, it doesn't matter if you're the lowest employee or the highest employee, you have to be paid at least – a minimum wage. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think Dee's concern was that she understood, and you correct me if I have misunderstood her, she understood that as a caregiver, she is an employee, and that there is some law that says you cannot, as a caregiver, be an independent contractor. Is that true?
Whether there's a specific law that applies only to caregivers, I'm not sure of that because what the law does is they use various factors to determine whether there's an employment relationship.
Yeah.
So if Dee's going to the same person every day and working mm-hmm. the same schedule and working a shift that the family is telling her that she should work and providing duties that the family says that she needs to provide mm-hmm. and they're providing her with the tools that she needs in order to do her job and they're directing how she does it and when she does it and so forth – well, it starts to paint a picture that she's, in fact, an employee.
Yeah.
And if the employer insists on classifying her as an independent contractor, mm-hmm. then she can always go to the labor commissioner, the California Labor mm-hmm. Commissioner, mm-hmm. and make a complaint there. Mm-hmm. And the labor commissioner will decide whether she's properly classified.
I see.
So there is a recourse for her.
But there, before they have – if I understood her correctly, she hasn't yet started working there for her client.
I heard her say that she had been an employee and they wanted to make her.
Oh, pardon me. All right. So that's where there was some interference with at least with what I had. So she is already working there with
correct.
This person.
And now they want to they want to change the status of employee.
See.
And there's some employers do that, mm-hmm. not this particular employer because we don't know this employer. Some employers do that, for example, so they can save on the payroll taxes.
Well, sure.
If you're paying a consultant, you're not paying
of
the payroll taxes.
Same with the health insurance.
You know, Dee, also one of the things I might mention, I see that you are in Mill Valley. What you might want to do to further, let's say, bolster where you are and what you feel your rights should be, I would recommend that you might want to contact since San Francisco, but I think Marin County also has its own lawyer referral service. But certainly my suggestion is you might want to get a half an hour consultation with an employment law attorney who represents employees and make sure that you feel comfortable in terms of what's going on. I'll give you the number again for the San Francisco Bar Association lawyer referral, and if there is a specific, let's say, lawyer referral office in Marin County other than the San Francisco bars, they'll certainly tell you. But the San Francisco Bar Mediation and Lawyer Referral Service, 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616. Good luck to you, by the way. David, welcome to the program. David, are you there? Hello, David?
Yes, hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks for this show. And first, I better ask, can you hear me okay?
You're fine. You're just fine.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, maybe it's just a short question that I want to pose. I'm a cab driver and for years, and I know the taxi cab regulation has gone back a couple hundred years, and I don't see the difference between a cab and an Uber car, except in its elaboration and its sophistication that Uber has. And so, and here's my question. There's a background to law that governs taxi cabs, and that's the PC and N. That's public convenience and necessity. And I think that Uber is not complying with that background law, which hasn't brought up very much, hasn't been brought up by people very much. But you got to have a service that's reliable and it's safe, safe from assault, safe in the vehicle traffic, and also predictable in its rates. And that's PCNN. Can someone talk about this?
Well, have you also, by any chance, contacted the Public Utilities Commission about this, David?
Oh, I've brought it up at hearings. I don't see, and our mayor is not very useful.
You're talking about Ed Lee.
My mayor is not very useful.
Yeah.
If he knows about PCNN, and that thing goes back hundreds of years, and it's probably over several countries, including England. I don't think he knows about it.
Okay.
But there's standards for taxicabs and for public conveyance. And why don't we just kind of have everybody comply with that?
Let me get some comments for you, David. Thank you very much for calling. Turn your radio back on, if you would. Do either of you have any comments for David on this?
Yeah, there's a tab. Yeah, thanks, Chuck and David. I don't disagree. I think I don't know the PCNN law. I have a general familiarity with the background checks and the vetting required for the cab industry, and great respect for it. And I still use them, and a lot of people do. And I think you guys are still, there's a big need for you guys and for your industry. I think there's been some backlash on the transportation network companies like Uber and Lyft because of news items about violent acts and property crimes. And I think there's litigation right now regarding, and there's been advances by Uber to do more vetting to prevent these incidents from happening. But I agree with what Chuck said. I think you've got to voice your opinions, David, down at City Hall, and make sure that you're heard, because that this is an ongoing dialogue, and I think that we're just going to see more driver entrance.
And I also think through the California Public Utilities Commission, because there is a segment of the PUC that deals with, I believe, with Uber, Lyft, etc.
I'm not sure. I think you're right, Chuck. And I think what we're headed next, although I'm not sure how quick we're going to get there, is Uber's going to remove that by saying, look, okay, you want background checks? We don't have drivers anymore. We just have cars that drive around. So we have driverless cars. So there's no need for a background check. There's no driver. Maybe that's the next app. I hope
that doesn't come to that. We're going to take, I think our last caller will be Jennifer. Jennifer, welcome to the program. Jennifer, are you there? Hello, Jennifer.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hi.
Hey. So I just wanted to provide some feedback on Airbnb, because your earlier caller had such a negative experience.
Go ahead.
And I had a situation just this spring after having used Airbnb many times in a trip with my mother. We did a road trip in England and Wales and Scotland, had absolutely lovely time. Everybody we met was fantastic. I've used it in Northern California, in Oregon, no problems. In New Orleans, I went to this guy's house, and he was completely insane. He to the point where he double booked and asked me to move to a different property.
Oh my.
And the other property had recently been vacated by some tenants, and it had a for sale sign in front of it, so I wasn't even sure that I was legally allowed to be there. He cleaned it up. He gave me, a small, cash refund toward the difference, but, and I wanted to, go along with, I was there for Jess. I wasn't really there to spend a lot of time hanging out where I was sleeping anyway, but it just got to the point where, the guy was nuts. Like, he accused me of taking all the towels and hiding them in my closet, and he only brought three towels to the house for me, the other Airbnb guest, and himself. he wasn't cleaning up after his dog. And when I said, hey, look, I cleaned up after your dog, of course, it was somebody else's fault. Everything was somebody else's fault. We didn't have a toilet that we could flush. We had to get a bucket of water.
Oh.
And it was somebody else's fault that it wasn't working. You know, none of the amenities that I had contracted for were in this new property. And finally, when I asked him, I said, hey, I've been sleeping on these sheets for a week at home. I change my sheets every weekend. Is there a chance you could bring some clean sheets over when you go back to the other house? He flipped out and started telling me how I didn't understand the pressure he was under and all this other stuff was going on. And I'm like, I don't have to. I am your guest. I contracted for certain services, and I'm not your roommate. I'm not your big sister. I don't have to listen to all your problems. I mean, seriously, it was constant, ongoing.
Well, let me ask you this, Jennifer. Did you make any effort to try to get ask Airbnb to reimburse you to some degree?
Yes, I did.
Did you? And what happened? We're nearly out of time. What happened?
I explained to them the situation. They were very sympathetic. They asked that I take photos to document the place that he had moved me to, and they agreed that this is absolutely not the same level of services that I had contracted. They spoke with him and said, hey, give her a discount, you know, because he had lowered the price, and he refused, and so they just gave me a full discount and took the money away from him. And
so you got your money back?
I got all my money back.
Good for you.
I kept the $100 that he already gave me. He wanted it back. But I was like, no, because there's a cleaning fee and there's a service fee for Airbnb, and I think you should cover that. And actually just told him to pay
Jennifer,
for the request, and I ignored
it. You are a great consumer.
And the next guy I went to was also Airbnb. He was two blocks away. He was super nice, and he was also driving a Lyft vehicle. And super great guy. He was like, oh, hey, I'm over in the Fairgrounds neighborhood. Can I take you up and bring you back to the house? And I was like, awesome. What a host.
Well, I appreciate your telling us about this. And also, I'm very pleased that you were able to get your money back from Airbnb because of the dismal, to say the least, situation that you were subjected to. Thank you very much for calling. I greatly appreciate.
You just have to document, you know, and like.
Yeah, we got to move on, my dear. We're running out of time, so I thank you very much for calling, and I hope that is it your plan that you are going to use Airbnb again? Do you think?
I've already used it again.
Oh, you have.
Yeah.
Well, you're a strong consumer, and you know that if you've got a problem, you know how to handle it or do the best you can, and you've been successful so far. So congratulations.
Yep.
That's what I like to hear. I like to hear good, strong consumers. I want to thank you both very much for joining me on the program.
Chuck.
It's been a great pleasure to have you here. You've both been guests before. Business and employment law attorneys Tad Devlin, partner in the San Francisco law firm of Kaufman, Dolovich and Volokh. And Aaron Minnis, partner in the San Francisco law firm of Minnis and Smollett. They're both panelists for the San Francisco Marin Lawyer Referral and Information Service of the San Francisco Bar. Next time on Your Legal Rights, we're going to have a discussion of major current landlord-tenant issues in California. My guests will be California real estate attorneys Walter Scheflow, Steve McDonald, and David Finkelstein. And also next week, if you're listening to the program live, August 24th is our monthly Call a Lawyer night when you can talk with attorneys off the air about any of several different legal areas while I'm doing the live program. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McClain. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Additional funding of the program is made possible by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program. Thanks for joining us on Your Legal Rights, and please join us next time on your public radio station. I'm Chuck Finney. Thank you.